The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Hey, good morning, Rick.
Good morning, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. I probably watch too much Fox News, but you know, I like to think of our show as kind of the no spin zone for what's happening in the tax world, because there's a lot of baloney floating around out there in political circles these days about tax relief, and so on our show we tell you how it really is. What's really happening and how you can really plan, because it's tricky. And, these guys that spend their whole life in Congress or in some political office seem unable to help themselves about trying to deceive people into thinking that things are really great and that they've given us something. So anyway, Rick, speaking of giving, one thing that I get a lot of questions about these days, and you reminded me that this happens every time they raise the capital gains rates, is how charitable giving works in this whole scheme. And so I thought it would be great to have a show, and especially since you're one of the experts in the country on charitable giving tools and structures, and so I thought it would be fun to have a show where I play the dumb guy, which is really easy for me to do, and ask a lot of questions about these charitable structures and how they work. So that's what we're going to do today on our show, and we hope that those who are listening out there, they have questions, that they email us, text us, call us, because this is a hot area and it's going to get hotter. So, but as always, we want to jump into our news section. And I know that you have some things you wanted to discuss there, Rick. So
yeah,
let me shoot it over to you.
Well, I want to comment. If you have to play the dumb guy, that puts me in a real awkward position, because if we get a tough tax question, the lawyer always says, hey, ask the CPA that question. So,
as you know, Rick, I asked myself a question this morning, and you gave me the same answer. Well, let's ask the CPA, and I don't know the answer. So,
I want to hit a couple of things on the news front. One, somebody gave me a copy of the February consumer report, and it has seven money stumbles listed in it. We won't take time to elaborate on these, but a couple of big ones. Number one was not updating your wills and beneficiaries on retirement accounts, and that is huge. And number two was not sharing information with family. And I gotta tell you, I see this one a lot. When somebody becomes incapacitated for illness or passes away, and the family members have to come and clean up the mess, not knowing where stuff is and how it's structured is just catastrophic. And then a couple others we ought to mention, messing up 401ks and other retirement plans. We've had shows on that and how to do that, but that's a big enough issue that it's made it to the Consumer Reports. And then the last one I'll mention, we won't hit all seven. You'll have to actually go online or buy the magazine to find out. But the other one is underinsuring. And that's, we also see that in the legal and tax planning we do, that there are risks out there that a prudent person ought to, can, should insure against. And number one being death, the probability of which is 100%. And so a good estate plan, a good financial plan will include an insurance component. And those are the four biggies that are getting neglected. The other thing I really want to mention that I think is just fascinating is this is the 100th anniversary of the three biggest progressive, quote unquote, changes in the American legal system that have happened and that have triggered an enormous number of other great shifts in our legal system and in the constitutional balance of power. The first of the three is in 1913, that's when we amended the Constitution to allow for the direct election of senators. So the senators were previously elected by the state legislators, and now they are, as everyone knows, popularly elected in the state. And the effect of that was to shift power away from the states to the federal government, because these senators get in there and they're in there for forever, and the state legislatures, which are often far more conservative than the Senate, lacks the power now to call the senators home and say, hey, in our state we're concerned about X, Y, and Z, you go back and represent our state. Instead, the senators are popularly elected, and that just changes the landscape. Two other big, huge things. 1913 was when we adopted the Federal Reserve. Now, we had had federal banks prior to that, although there was a deep constitutional conflict and discussion over whether or not we could or should have a central bank. But in 1913, we adopted the Federal Reserve, and we also, by constitutional amendment, adopted the income tax. Prior to it required a constitutional amendment. The federal government was not allowed to tax income, and we changed the deal. And there's been a lot of things said by economists about the combination of the income tax and the Federal Reserve, and we're going to hit on some of these issues today. So it really segues nicely into our program. As everybody knows, taxpayers aren't stupid. If you tax our income, we're going to earn less. And so there is an upper limit on how much revenue can be raised through income taxes, because if you make the rates too high, people will just stop working, or they'll shift their income to other kinds of tax favored thing. So we have this combination tax revenue federal revenue through taxation with the income tax on the one hand, and then federal spending through the printing press with the Federal Reserve on the other hand. And this has given politicians these wonderful tools to spend money and print money when they can't tax it. And we're seeing 100 years of consequences of that, and all the trillions and trillions of dollars of federal debt stacking up. Which brings us down to one of the things people do, have historically done, when hit with all these taxes is, gee, if I can't keep the money anyway, if it's not going to be mine and I've got to give it up, I'd rather, instead of giving it to the politicians and instead of having those guys decide what to do with it, I'd rather give the money to a charity and let a charity decide what to do with it. And not surprisingly, the charitable arena has also been under attack from the progressive political machine in America. And it was floated a few years back and has been floated actually many, many times over the past century too. And we can talk more about this. I know, Rich, you've got some material on this. But the idea has frequently been floated. Maybe we should eliminate the charitable deduction. And every time that idea comes up, it is met with a howl of protest from charities and from their supporters who believe that private initiative, non-governmental programs are more efficient and a better way to address social problems, and that people ought to have the freedom to choose where their dollars go. And so the direct frontal attack, frontal assault on the charitable deduction has failed. And so progressives, being as clever as they are, have done a flanking maneuver and have diluted or reduced the charitable deduction with the phase out of all deductions. And I guess we're going to explore some of how that has applied, Rich.
Well, yeah, we are. And if anyone was wondering earlier, the question that I asked was, so we have all these limitations on the charitable deduction. You know, some of them are worth 30%, some 50, some 20, and that percentage is referring to the percentage of your adjusted gross income that you can deduct as a charitable deduction each year, and the rest of it carries forward for 5 years. So I'm really clear on how that all works. I guess what I wasn't clear on, and probably still am not completely clear, is what happens with the phase out. So if you phase out those deductions, so you pass the test on the 50% of AGI, but then you phase them out, phase out the deductions because your income is too high, then, and we've been through this before, but it's just like I tell Rick, you know, if you don't deal with it for a couple of years, you're not really sure. I'll figure out the answer to that. But my suspicion is that it doesn't carry forward. So
yeah, my guess is the way to figure it out is to try it in your software and see what the software produces on a tax return.
Right. Yeah.
I'm being a little cynical.
But no, you're right. That's assume that the software developers know what they're doing. So, and they usually do. So, one other thing, Rick, on the news side here, and it's just it's right along the line of what you're talking about, is the charitable tax deduction was implemented not in 1913 but in 1917, so 4 years later, and it's actually never been changed except for this phase out that of itemized deductions, this flanking maneuver that you just talked about. And so experts estimate that if it were ever eliminated entirely, estimated losses to the charitable community would be somewhere in the $75 to $108 billion range. And, you know, the other thing that would happen...
Now, let's be clear. That would run the federal government for what, 7 or 8 days?
Maybe.
Maybe.
I'm not really sure.
not long. It would kill an industry. It would kill private initiative, but it would not solve the fiscal problem we have with the federal government. But it would move power to the federal government and away from private individuals. And it would eliminate our ability to make our own choices. So the progressive dream come true.
Right. And I'm not really sure. I still, you know, in America, I still haven't quite figured out how we ended up with these progressives that want to give away their freedom, but that maybe they don't understand that's what's happening. But the other thing that would happen, Rick, which would run completely counter to what we really need, is charitable tax-exempt organizations employ 10% of the workforce in this country. So, you know, impact the amount of money that goes to them, and we also drive up unemployment. And they actually pay out around $670 billion a year in wages and benefits. So that's 9% of all wages and benefits in the country. So, you know, this is an important area and one that is near and dear to our hearts. And so we're going to talk about it today and, you know, how we can structure things because – There are some great things that you can do with charitable vehicles, and we've seen many of our clients do it, and we see the benefits. And so it's a great, great topic we want to talk about. So I thought what I would do today is just ask Rick a lot of questions and see where we get on this, because there's a huge gamut of charitable giving here, and we want to try to at least skim the surface on a number of these things, so we kind of our listeners out there understand a little bit about what is available. So we've talked about a number of these things, Rick, before, but I know the Donor Advised Fund, or the DAF as it's called, is gaining a lot of popularity, and you know, the growth in those funds has been, you know, nothing short of phenomenal over the past 3 or 4 years. So tell us what those are, and a little bit of about how they work. And I kind of like to know, you know, why do people do that? What, you know, what's the advantage to someone? Because people just don't do these things for fun. They're usually because there's an advantage of some kind to doing it.
Yeah, well, let's give some history. Prior to the income tax, people could make money and it was theirs. They got to keep it. And when they started taxing income, then the question arose, well, what about income earned by churches? What about income earned by the soup kitchen? What about income earned by these what are called charities today? And prior to that income tax, obviously, churches were not taxed, so tax status was not an issue. And when they instituted this charitable deduction, that's when they also instituted what is now called the 501c3 tax-exempt organization. And there are actually, under Section 501c of the code, there are a whole bunch of different tax-exempt organizations, unions and trade organizations and other things. And the 501c3 deals with tax-exempt organizations that are engaged in charitable activities. Now, notably, churches do not have to be a 501c3. There's another section of the federal code which recognizes that churches are simply tax-exempt, period. And the only kind of taxes they have to pay are payroll taxes when they have employees and things like that. So the 501c3 was initially to recognize non-church charitable organizations. And there were two types. There are still two types. There's public charities and private charities. And a public charity, you know, the general kind of rule of thumb, the intuitive answer to what's a public charity, is a charity with public support. It's supported by lots and lots of people who contribute to it. It has independent control. It might be affiliated with a government, so there might be some kind of a public-private partnership where it's running a public housing for example, running a museum or something that's also publicly owned, you know, owned by the state. But then there were these private foundations, which are charities that are tightly controlled by an individual or that individual's family. And there are different tax rules apply to different ones. And the private charity, on the one hand, creates, I think, the illusion – it's not real – the illusion that the private individual has more control. The public charity has public control. So people who wanted to have their own foundation would go out and create a private charity. So you hear all these historical multi-billionaires have their name foundation, and that's where they came from. And they today fund all kinds of charitable activities. And in current history, the one that is the most well-known and probably has become the biggest is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I recently saw a quote from Mr. Gates saying that money no longer means anything to him. It's completely meaningless. He doesn't care. He's not trying to make any more money. He's simply trying to figure out a way to create some kind of a legacy that will outlive him, which is a big challenge. So we see, yeah, the Gates Foundation, the DuPont Foundation, the who, all the Steel people, the Forbes Foundation, all these famous names from history pop up as with foundations. Well, to set up that kind of a charity, first of all, they're really expensive. It's expensive to set them up. It's expensive to run them. They have extreme oversight with the IRS. Their tax deductions are restricted. Instead of deducting up to 50% of your adjusted gross income, you can only deduct up to 30%. And if it's an appreciated asset, instead of deducting up to 30% of your adjusted gross income, which you can with a public charity, with a private charity, you can only deduct up to 20%. So private foundations give this illusion of control, but really your chain is being yanked by the IRS and you have all these taxes. So along in the late 70s, early 80s, somebody come up with the idea, what if we had a public charity? And they kind of went through several iterations of this, but what if we had a public charity with broad public support, an independent board? It's not run by the Carnegies or by Bill Gates or anybody like that. It's run, you know, has public control. But we're going to allow a donor to have their own separate little fund under this umbrella. And we'll let them name it and we'll let them direct it. And for a while they were called donor-directed funds. And then there was some litigation and the IRS said, well, if the donors can actually direct it, there's no longer the independent oversight. So they kind of spanked them for that. So now the donors cannot direct them. The donors can only advise them. So that's kind of where we are today. A public charity can allow a donor to have this fund, a separate fund. It can be separately named that the donor can advise. And the donor's advice can be along several lines. The donor can advise how the funds are invested. So the donor can say, well, I'm afraid of the stock market going crazy, so I want to be in all cash. The donor can say, oh, I'm afraid the currency is going to collapse, so I want to be in all gold. The donor can say, I'm a believer in the modern portfolio system, so I want that modern balanced portfolio approach. The donor can say, this is my guy. This is my investment advisor, whoever this is, this man or woman, and I want this person that I trust to be in control of the money or to manage the investments. So the donor can advise the investments. Then the donor can advise.
Hey, Rick.
Yeah. We need to take a break, don't we?
Yeah,
let's take a break.
We better go to break and then come back and continue on this. Very interesting. So let's go to break. We'll be back in just a minute or two.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Are you a business innovator, or are you just sitting on the sidelines? Tune in every week for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Host Bonnie D. Graham talks to a cross-section of the movers and shakers who are leading by example. They will share best practices and innovative ideas to keep you thinking and moving along with the best. Join us for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We all face some economic uncertainty in our life. What makes the difference is how we take command of that and survive. Tune in to Strategies for Financial Survival with host Michael Figueroa. Michael has been up and down the road to success several times, and along with his guests, will share the skills of survival. By assessing your strengths and skills and applying them to your future, you can make it through tough times, regardless of your field. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back. Hey, Rick, the history on how the Donor Advised Fund came about, very interesting. I think that helps people put it in context. And since we want to make sure everyone knows how to use these and why they're important and how they can be used by clients or individuals to reduce their tax liability or manage it, let's jump into that and talk about how that all works. And I know that at Legacy Global Foundation, which is a foundation that you actually head up, you have a lot of this kind of money in the foundation. So tell us why people do it and how it works well for them.
Well, the other half that the donor can advise is who gets the money. So the donor can say, please operate this fund as a permanent endowment and spin off the income to support these charities. Or the donor can say, you know what, I want to give a big chunk. I want to give all of it. And depending on the donor advised fund, that can happen. And technically the way it happens is the donor advises those suggestions. I suggest you give the money to the Red Cross. I suggest you give the money to the donor's church or the donor's school or the donor's local community, whatever. And then the independent board has to look at that, and they have some T's to cross and some I's to dot. They have to make sure that we're not breaking any laws, that the money's not going to a disallowed person or to terrorists or politicians, and it's sometimes difficult to tell which is which there. But there's certain things that are just not allowed, and so the independent board makes sure they're following all the rules, and then they make sure that wherever the money's going, it in fact qualifies as is in line with the charitable mission of the parent charity. So the independent board will do all that due diligence and then pass it out. So why do people do this? Well, you know, by the time you add up the taxes and the compulsory mandatory 5% distributions of of private foundations and the administrative overhead, They're very expensive to operate. I've heard numbers ranging from 8 to 15% of the funds each year in a private foundation will be spent in administrative overhead. And a donor-advised fund, because all of those costs are pooled and because we avoid some of the excise taxes and things like that, the administrative overhead for a donor advice fund hovers around 1%, which, by the way, if you look at any charity, go look at all the charities out there, go to some of the charity ranking sites, 1% is a screaming good deal. That's highly efficient. If the government could operate on 1%, it would be staggering. So 1% is outrageously efficient, and the money goes to the charitable causes. It does not get gobbled up in administrative nonsense. So why do people do this? Well, it allows them to have their own charitable endowment where they can support causes and social functions and do good with their money that they cannot otherwise do. You know, I heard somebody say this over the weekend. In fact, you can't take your money with you to heaven, but you can send it on ahead. I love that line. And by giving money to charity, it's kind of a way of sending it on ahead. I think the American people are outrageously generous, and they believe in giving relief to the poor and in curing horrible diseases and in fixing broken social institutions and in preserving our heritage. I just went to a state park and it was funded significantly with private contributions. We believe in that kind of stuff, and we will on our own, without being compelled to do so, support many good causes. And the donor advised fund kind of democratizes the private foundation. It allows individuals that don't have hundreds of millions or billions of dollars to have a foundation that they can put some money in. that they can get the charitable deduction for today. They can invest that social capital and build it up and then support causes that they believe in. So the entry level here, it varies from organization to organization. Some of the sponsors that have advised funds have different thresholds. Legacy has a zero threshold. You can set it up empty and not to get anything until you're dead. Or you can set it up with, you know, 12 cents. They have no threshold. And
so, Rick, I wanted to ask a question here. So, you know, we just went across a year end. And what I find with a lot of my clients is, you know, they look around in December and they look at what's happened with their income for the year, and they realize that it might be a good year to make a charitable contribution. But, you know, they're busy, and there's holidays, there's Christmas. And so setting up a donor advice fund, what I've noticed with my clients, it allows them to defer that decision about who it's actually going to go to, but they can get the deduction in the current year. And like you said, it's simple to set up. You know, you fill out a form. I've done this many times with with Legacy Global Foundation, and you know, voila, 10 minutes later you've got a donor advised fund, and they can plunk whatever amount they feel they want to give that year into that. And then as time progresses and things become more clear to them and they get through the New Year's parties, et cetera, then they can say, you know, I'd like some of that to go here, 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 and here. And they got the deduction and they ended up letting it go where they wanted it to go, but took it out of that time period. So, I mean, just on a very basic level, a lot of people I know do that. And then as you mentioned, you know, there are other people that set them up for long-term sort of. I know my sister-in-law has a donor advice fund, and every year she goes to Russia, and she has an orphanage, which is where her mother came from, that town. They set up some funding mechanisms so that they can go and help particularly girls that come out of those orphanage systems to get to college and avoid being on the street and prostitution and death and all the things that come along with that. So just a great way to fund a charitable cause that you believe in and isn't necessarily one that Bill Gates believes in or somebody else, and you can just do it yourself.
Sure, and you raised several issues there. Another thing I've adopted this phrase. I stole it from a donor who said we never send a check, we deliver the check. Even with a donor advised fund, even though it's not your signature on the check, most of the organizations will let you deliver it. The check is made out to your orphanage in Siberia or whatever, but they'll say, here, you take the check, you carry it there, you hand it to them, you get to see firsthand what's happening. So that's really cool. And the example you mentioned, in fact, I think we have some of your clients that have set up advice funds at the end of the year and popped in whatever sum of money. Then during the course of the year, they'll buy tubas for their local high school band, and they will give books to their local library, and they will support an orphanage in Siberia or whatever. They do all these kinds of things that are really, really cool, and they do them because they want to. They've checked them out. They've vetted the charity. They've said, "Look, I've checked these guys out, and they run a good shop. They're not cheating. They're actually helping people, and I'm going to go volunteer and work as a volunteer. But I would like them to get some money while I'm there volunteering. So it's just a beautiful, happy thing."
All right. Well, donor advice funds, we've got a whole lot of ground to cover here, Rick. So let's move on to some other the other sorts of vehicles that people can use. And you know many, many, many more of these acronyms than I do, but I wanted to talk about how a charitable remainder unit trust works, or a CRUT, a charitable remainder annuity trust, or a CRAT, I also had a lot of questions recently about charitable gift annuities. Those are all different, and each of them probably has its own, you know, several flavors. But talk to us about – let's start with a CRUT. A lot of people have heard about a CRUT or so tell us about those and who sets them up and why do they set them up and what can we accomplish?
Yeah, all of these that you mentioned, all of these little acronyms are a type of gift called a split interest gift. And a split interest gift is where we're going to take an asset and we're going to divide it up. And we're not going to divide it up in terms of, you know, 50 for you and 50 for me kind of thing. Or we're not going to divide it up like we would real estate and put a fence down the middle. We're going to divide it up over time. And we're going to divide it up over the income for now and the remainder when somebody dies. So we have the income interest and the remainder interest. And typically the donor will give one of those away and keep one of them. So we split the interest. And the donor keeps a piece and gives away a piece. And the most common use of this is where the donor keeps the income for life or for a term of years, keeps the income piece, and gives away the remainder at their death. And that can be done either as a trust or as an annuity. And the gift annuity is the annuity type, and the trust is the charitable remainder uni trust or the charitable remainder annuity trust. And let's talk about what this means and why people do it. It's typically done when there is some kind of event that is going to result in a huge tax. And this is why suddenly this is interesting to people again, is because for a long time the capital gains taxes have been low enough that when people have a capital gain event that would result in a tax, their attitude has been, oh yeah, you know, it's a tax, but it's a tax I can live with, so I'll just pay the tax and move on. Well, now they've nearly doubled that tax. Not quite, but when you add in all the state and other stuff, it's just about double what it used to be. So now
And the Obamacare tax.
Whacks
another 4% on top of it.
Right. So now people say, wait, that tax hurts. Ouch. And they start asking their CPAs and their lawyers, when I'm going to have this capital event, which I anticipate at some point in the future, is there anything I can do about that tax? And there is. And these split interest gifts are one of them. So when we're going to sell the farm, and let's say we bought it in 1952 for $12, and it's now worth $1 million. And so we have essentially $1 million of gain. And we would pay a big, huge percentage of that. We're going to have the capital gains tax. We're going to have the unearned income excise tax. We're going to have state taxes. So at the end of the day, it'll be a pretty big chunk of that money's going to be taken away by taxes. And the donor says, can I not pay that? And we can. So they can put the farm in this charitable remainder trust and sell the farm. And because the charitable remainder trust is a charity, it's a tax exempt entity, it does not pay any capital gains tax. Score! We got zero capital gains tax. And then it will invest the money and pay that money out to the donor. And the difference between a CRUT and a CRAT is a couple of big things. One is, how is the income calculated? And the annuity trust pays a fixed annuity amount every year that's fixed at the point of origin, and that's it. And the annuity trust is fixed at the point of origin, never changes. The uni trust, however, we can put in the farm this year, we can put in another farm next year, we can put in some contribute part of the investment portfolio or other assets in the future years. And then each year, the payout is calculated based upon a percentage of the total assets. And that's usually going to be a fixed percentage, but sometimes it can be the net income or the fixed percentage, whichever's less. So The trust format, a couple of key issues, is an actively managed entity. You have this trust, typically the donor and a charity will be co-trustees, is the most common thing we see, and each will have a different responsibility. And the funds are managed, they have to do accounting, they have to do tax returns, and the theory is the funds can be managed by really smart people who will make more money than they spend out, and so will have a hedge for inflation, and the income will go up over time. But that model doesn't work for everybody, so that's where we have the charitable gift annuity. And the charitable gift annuity is not a trust. This is a fire and forget. You do it one time, you set it up, and you get a guaranteed income for the rest of your life, and or for a term of years. And just like the trust, the CRUT, you can avoid capital gain on the sale of an appreciated asset, and you can get this guaranteed fixed income for life. Now, with the gift annuity, the income is guaranteed and it's fixed, so you don't have any adjustment for inflation. No matter how smart you are at managing the money, it's never going to go up. So we tend to see the gift annuity is favored by older people who are risk averse and who want a guaranteed income. The trust approach, the CRUT or the CRAT, tends to be favored by younger people who are risk tolerant, who are concerned about inflation, who think they can outperform the market, and who want to have more control. So the two vehicles are very powerful. Now, what is really cool, and I think that
let me ask you a question about that. So there are a number of annuities out there, and we've talked about some of these on our show, which are called fixed index annuities, which these really smart guys at insurance companies have figured out how to actually factor in a bit of a hedge against inflation, because they allow you to track indexes, and some of that indexing allows your are charitable groups like yours allowed to give an annuity like that? Let's think about that, and we'll talk about it when we come back from our break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
How can we Americans realize our dreams to earn a living? How can you pursue your dream and make money as an owner or an employee? Learn how at The American Business Person, the online weekly radio talk show hosted by Rich Killian. Today's business leaders share how to succeed and what fails. If you own a new or established business or ever hope to, you must tune in. Join us every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Central, and noon Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel, or listen on demand to our archived shows.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Okay, so Rick, I know we have other things to talk about, but tell me about these annuities, because I know when you have a charitable gift annuity, typically your organization will go out and buy a commercial annuity, to back that up so that you never have to worry about, well, there's going to be money there to pay the annuitant. So can you buy these different kinds of annuities that have the built-in?
That's a complex question, and I hope I can explain it in a way that people understand, because even this has been a point that people struggle with understanding. I need to back up and say that gift annuities are an interesting animal under the Philanthropy Protection Act. They are exempted from regulation as a security, so they are a non-regulated annuity. So they're not going to be governed by the securities laws of either your state or the federal government. Now, in exchange for that, the charities can't pay commissions and a whole bunch of other stuff, and each state will have its own compliance rules. Now, charities have voluntarily, for the most part, agreed to use a standard set of rates. And these rates are set by the American Council on Gift Annuities, and most charities follow those rates, and there are some regulatory benefits from following those rates. There are, however, a few charities out there, and sometimes you, on a case-by-case basis, you can persuade the charity issuing the gift annuity to deviate from that industry standard. Typically, the gift annuity rates are going to be lower than the commercial rates. So, but then the income might be advantaged. You might get some different tax treatment on the income coming out of that, and you'll get a tax deduction for the remainder interest of your gift annuity. So with a private annuity, you get a higher payout, and you get flexibility to do all this kind of indexing and all the creative things that commercial annuity providers offer. With a gift annuity, you don't get inflation adjusters. You do not get indexes. It's going to be a fixed payout, and mostly you may negotiate, well, give me a slightly higher payout or a slightly higher deduction for charitable deduction, and there's a trade-off there. If you get one, you don't get the other. But then the charity, let's keep our math simple. If you give the charity $100 and they agree to pay you 6 cents a year for the rest of your life to represent your interest on that $100, or I guess it would be $6 a year, would be 6%. So they're going to pay you $6 a year, 50 cents a month for the rest of your life with this gift annuity. Well, the charity's now got the $100, and the charity has two obligations. Number one, they have an obligation to pay you that $6 a year every year for the rest of your life. And number two, they have an obligation to have some money left over for charitable purposes when you die. Now, the charity can manage that however they want to within the scope of regulatory requirements. So different states actually have different rules. And one of the typical ways that you mentioned is the charity will say, well, we have these risks. We're not in the risk business. We're in the charity business. So we want to reinsure those risks. And they will go to a private commercial insurance company and say, we would like to buy financial products from you that guarantee our ability to make these annuity payments to this annuitant for as long as they live, and that guarantee that we will have some money left over for charitable purposes when this annuitant dies. And historically, that has ended up being that the charity, not the donor, the charity uses your $100 that you gave them. The charity uses your $100 to buy a combination of commercial annuities and maybe a life insurance policy or a life insurance rider on that annuity or something to guarantee those two things. Guarantee that we've got a no risk, a guaranteed income so that we can make that annuity payment to the donor for forever, even if they live to be 127. And when they die at age 127, we're going to have a sum of money left over for charitable purposes.
Okay. So that's a function that the charitable organization, the public charity, goes out, figures out how to cover those risks and make sure that happens. So.
Right. And there are some charities that say, hey, we are managing our own portfolios, and we've got really smart money people, and we have done our own actuarial studies, and we're comfortable with the risk. They'll take your $100 and they'll throw it into their pool of investments. And what the donor has to decide is, am I comfortable with that? Am I okay with the charity managing the $100 and that their guarantee of my income payment is going to be good? Or would I prefer to see the charity reinsuring that and having the financial backing of a big insurance company to guarantee the money?
Okay, so talk to us about how you – as I have a lot of families that I work with that have a CRUT, but they also have a donor advice fund. So how do those two things work together?
Well, remember that the split interest part of a CRUT or the gift annuity is that when you die, whatever's left has to go to charity. And the question is, what charity should it go to? And it can be your church or your hospital or your school. All of those public charities out there will happily take your CRUT, will happily run illustrations for it, and happily set it up. And they'll sometimes they'll even give you documents for free because you will irrevocably name that charity as the beneficiary when you die. And in fact, charities hire people. They put people on payroll to go out and roam the countryside looking for supporters who will do these kind of deals so that as their donors pass away, they have this big pipeline of money that's coming in. Well, with the donor advice fund, what you can do is name your foundation, your donor advice fund, as the remainder charity that's going to receive these benefits when you die. So if you've put the $1 million farm in a CRUT and it pays you your $60,000 a year every year for the rest of your life, and then when you're dead, where's the $1 million going to go? Well, it can go into your donor advice fund and it can support your charities. And this is something to look at carefully with different advice funds. Some of them have a limit on how many generations they can go or how much they'll allow your children or future generations to be involved. But the $1 million can go into this fund. It can support then as a permanent endowment your church, your school, your hospital, your favorite causes. And a huge thing, the donor advised fund can then hold your charities accountable to your values. There is a big problem in the nonprofit industry with what I call mission drift, where the charity starts out doing one thing, but then over time its mission changes and it gets taken over and there's new generation and new goals and over a generation or two the charity may end up doing exactly the opposite of what it started out to do. And there are some very famous examples of this. Gandhi actually wrote about it in his autobiography about funded charitable causes that are not accountable to the values of their donors ended up getting used, you know, would be set up to protect one segment of the population, and then it gets taken over by the enemies of that segment of the population, and they buy guns and bombs to kill the very people they were supposed to be protecting. And that's happened actually multiple times. So with a donor advised fund run by the family can keep that charity accountable, or the charities that are being supported accountable to the values of the founder, and prevent that mission drift.
So, and has that always been the case that you've been able to prevent mission drift, or is that something that's more recent?
Well, that's always been a tool that's been available. I think what's new is people's awareness of that. Some classic examples. There are Ivy League schools, which we will leave nameless here, that were founded as religious institutions to promote God and country, from which the religion has been completely excised. It has been removed, cut out, and disenfranchised, and now those institutions are in fact hostile to and even the enemy of the religions that they were established to support and encourage. So that the problem of mission drift has always been there. The solution of allowing the donor advised fund or whatever to hold the charity accountable is relatively new. That's with the donor advised fund. And let me give you an example. I had some years ago a client establish a donor advised fund, and it was supporting a woman's shelter. that was near and dear to the heart of the donor. It's an organization that the donor helped to start, and that the donor had volunteered countless hours of time and energy in setting up. And it was affiliated with a religious organization, and it had certain values, and I'm going to remain as neutral as I can on this on the air, but it had certain values that were consistent with the religious organization. Well, after the donor died, the woman's shelter got into financial trouble. The religious organization sold it to a hospital. The new management came in and brought in money and people and resources and actually did some very good things. But they also had a new set of values that were completely contrary to and even hostile to the religious sentiments of the founders. And the children of the donor, who were still advising the fund, were able to say to the parent charity, hey, this woman's shelter is no longer consistent with our mother's wishes. We would like to find a new one. And the parent charity said, well, of course, go find a new one. And so they did. They went and found another woman's organization that was still supporting women, still in keeping with mom's original vision, but was now no longer being hijacked and used for something contrary to what mom had originally intended. So that's a problem that is eternal. The solution, I think, is relatively new.
All right. So to summarize here, and I wanted to mention one thing that we intended to mention at the beginning but didn't. There is a concept in this new tax law which allows, and this is a January kind of decision that needs to be made, is that if you have an IRA, and many people out there have these large IRAs that they want to spend on other things than themselves, because they have more money than, and they see that they're not going to use this. You can take a required minimum distribution, or an RMD if you're over 70 and a half, up to $100,000, and gift that to your donor advised fund. And so, just because it is time sensitive, get out there and do that, and that will allow you to support charitable causes from this money that you have in your IRAs. So, enjoy the show. Call us with any questions, and we'll be back here again in another week.
Thank you for listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.